Today's case show will be on case 42 in the Book of Serenity, the Book of Equanimity. Case 42 is entitled Nan Yang's Water Pitcher. Introduction. Washing the bowl, adding water to the pitcher, all are aspects of the teaching, Buddha work. Hauling firewood and carrying water are all miraculous powers of sublime functions. Why can't you emanate light and make the earth move? Case. A monk asked national teacher Zhang of Nanyang, what is the Virochana of one's own body? The national teacher said, bring me the pitcher of clean water. The monk brought the pitcher. The national teacher said, put it back where it was before. The monk again asked, what is the Virochana in one's own body? The national teacher said, the ancient Buddha is long gone. Verse. Birds coursing through the sky, fishes being in the water, in rivers and lakes forgetting. In clouds and sky they get their will. The doubting mind a single thread. Before the face a thousand miles. Knowing benevolence, requiting benevolence, how many people do? Commentary. The flight of birds in the sky, the fish in the water, their roosts are ever more peaceful. Their life is ever more harmonious. Chuanzi said, when the spring is dry, the fish together on the land puff at each other to moisten their lips with wetness from their mouths. This does not compare to forgetting each other in the rivers and the lakes. Chan Master Tongwei Gui from Baijiao said, it is like flying birds in the sky. They don't know the sky is their home. The fish swimming in the waters forget that the water is their life. Guifeng said, the fish are not conscious of the water. People are not conscious of the air. Delusion is not conscious of reality. Enlightenment is not conscious of emptiness. Usually, the personal Virochana, complete pure awareness, manifests form in the human realm. But as soon as it is questioned, suddenly a shadow appears. You forget the blessings you have received, turn away from your parents and go to strangers. Ultimately, if he can get rid of the spiritual seat, only then can the son take up the father's work. But tell me, what is the father's work? When brought up, there's nothing that it is not. Don't doubt its use. Well, this is day four, I had to count, day four of our winter sesshin. It feels like spring out there. We started out with very cold weather, and today it's really beautiful, really wonderful out there. Some of you may not know that if you go behind this complex of buildings, there's a trail which is on national forest land, and it goes all the way to the ocean. It's quite a walk, so please don't try to do it today, but you can go for a walk on that trail, and it's very pretty even in the winter on a day like today. This is, when you're out there in the forest, it's a very beautiful experience. You know, there's something special about that. you know, that forest land is much abused, I have to say, you know. If you go on the path that goes all the way to the water, you'll see strange things, so that there are like holes in the road that people have dug, and you'll come along and you'll see that kids with hatchets have chopped to pieces trees, and you might see some lawn furniture out there, and it's a bit beaten up, but all the same, it's struggling, and some of it is still quite beautiful. You know, some of it's quite beautiful. And even on a winter's day, if you go out there, somehow people often feel some. It's like your tension drops away. You begin to feel relaxed and connected. At least this is often this often happens to people. And so it's a good complement to your meditation practice. And if you're working on the mu koan, you can go out into the woods and you can scream mu. You know, you can call mu. Scream isn't right, but you can call mu. And if you're working on the koan, that's an excellent thing to do. If you call mu very loudly, nobody's going to be bothered by it. So don't worry about that. But even if you call mu, I think you'll find that there's still a kind of mood to the forest that's very special. You know, every once in a while I meet somebody who doesn't like the natural world, and I think that's very surprising. You know, there are people who actually don't like to be out in nature. It makes them nervous. You know, it makes them uncomfortable. And I find that very odd. You know, and I was reading in the newspaper the other day that the number of people who are attending national parks has begun to drop. And I worry about all these kids who grow up in suburban neighborhoods sitting in front of a computer screen. And maybe on the computer screen they have a little screensaver of Yosemite or something. But, you know, I worry that they're not going out there and encountering the natural world. It's getting harder and harder, really, to encounter that world. We keep encroaching on it and so on. But there's something special about it. It's really interesting. Many years ago, I had started sitting with Genki Roshi at the Seattle Zen Center. And I remember finishing a sesshin and going down to New Mexico for a vacation in the summer. And in those days, my wife and I actually used to hitchhike down to New Mexico from Seattle. And it was quite an adventure. You know, the days of hitchhiking are really over, I think. But at that time, hitchhiking was an acceptable mode of hippie transportation. Mm-hmm. And I myself had hitchhiked all over the United States, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. I hitchhiked all the way from Washington, D.C. to Seattle, and I hitchhiked all the way from Seattle to Albuquerque, New Mexico. And I hitchhiked from Albuquerque to California, and I hitchhiked all the way up Route 101 in California. And California was difficult because there were so many hippies, you know. So you would get up in the morning and, you know, you'd say, I've got to get on the road to catch a ride, and you'd get out. You weren't really allowed to hitchhike on the interstate itself. But in the state of California, you can stand on the ramp. You can stand, and you can get pretty far down the ramp as long as you're not technically on the interstate. So usually there was a sign that said, no hitchhiking beyond this point. And you'd get out there, or I'd get out there in the morning, and there'd be like five guys lined up waiting for rides, you know. That kind of competition made it difficult to get a ride. I still have dreams about that, believe it or not. In fact, I think I had one just the other day. I was hitchhiking, and there were all these guys in front of me, and I thought, oh, I'll never get a ride. I'll be here all day, you know. So the hitchhiking in California was tough, you know, it was difficult. But I hitchhiked all over, and then my wife and I hitchhiked from Seattle down to Albuquerque in the summer, after a big summer sashimi. And we could do it in 3.5 days. It was amazing. That might seem like a long time, but you could hardly drive faster than that. So, first of all, my wife is very attractive looking, and she has a smiley face, and so it helped enormously to have her, you know. So, you know, we'd be out on the road, and she'd smile and look cute, you know, and somebody would pick us right up. And usually from Seattle, they were going all the way to Montana, you know, which is a huge ride, but there's nothing between. Except for the city of Spokane, there's nothing between Seattle and Montana. So we would get this massive ride. And then when we were in Montana, we had a place that I knew, a campground that was right on the interstate. And then the next day, we in Montana, you can hitchhike right on the interstate. It's okay. And we'd get a ride down through the Yosemite area, down through... that part of Livingston Valley area, Livingston, Montana, and the Yellowstone River Valley, which was glorious. You know, standing out on the road, and you know the mountains, these giant mountains, and there's just these big open spaces. It was just a glorious experience. And then we'd get into Colorado, usually the next day, and then maybe it would take a couple days to get down, but generally, you know, within 3.5 days, the last leg, we'd leave Colorado and we'd get into Albuquerque, you know. And so anyway, we were staying in Albuquerque, and we decided to go up to this place called Elephant Butte, which is a man-made lake. It was Heron Lake. Heron Lake. It's a man-made lake in northern New Mexico. And my father-in-law used to have a boat, and he loved to go fish. He loved to sit in his boat and fish. And we would all fish with him. And I would quietly not put a worm on my hook, and I'd just throw it in the water and sit there and pray that nothing bit the hook, you know. And indeed, my father-in-law hardly ever caught anything, so we were pretty safe. At one time we were moored to the edge of the lake, and I got up early in the morning to do my zazen. And I went into this area that was, a forested area. And I'll never forget, it was like one of the deepest sits I ever had, you know. It was like body and mind just melted away, and it was astonishing. It was one of the deepest sits I've ever had, and I've had that kind of experience on other occasions too. When I was in Seattle, at one time I was living in a town called Paulsbo, Washington. And Paulsbo was filled with, I was the only non-Norwegian in town, you know. You could, in those days I used to have black hair. And if I was walking around town, you would see there's 528 people who were blondes, and there's one guy with black hair, and it was me, you know. And everybody there were like Norwegian people who had settled there, and they had a fishing fleet in Paulsbo. And I was working as a carpenter in Silverdale, which is near Paulsbo. And I was living in this crummy little house up on the hill, and one day which I was sharing with a number of other people who were like a very noisy, and they liked to drink, and it was a bad scene, as we used to say. And so I wanted to do some zazen, so I walked out of the house, and I didn't know where I was going, but I walked to the end of the road, and there was this little trail going into the woods, and I sat down, I found a place in the woods again. It was like this little opening in the forest, and I sat, and again, I've never forgotten it. It was such a deep sit. It was like I melted away. I think that was even before the Heron Lake experience, you know. But there was something about those, that setting, you know, doing zazen in that setting, that was just, it was almost like it was a dream. You could say it was dreamlike, except it felt so good, you know, it felt so good. And I felt, it was like myself disappeared, and I was just aware of everything around me, you know. And we feel this on the cushion too. This can happen to you on the cushion, and when it does, it's really glorious. And I worry that you know, kids these days just don't get that experience. You know, they're in the house all the time. They don't go wandering off into the woods. They might, you know, never had that experience, something like that, you know. There's something, I think it's fair to say, that there's something unnatural about the way we live, you know. There's something really, totally unnatural about the way we live. And it's complicated. It's not just that we don't have a lot of woods around here in New Jersey, you know, and fewer trees every day, you know. It's more than that. It has to do with our mental landscape too, you know. The two things kind of go together. You know, the two things kind of go together. The other day I mentioned that I really didn't understand nature myself until I had joined the Boy Scouts. And I went on a 50-mile hike, and the bugs bit me, and I ate blueberries and had an allergic reaction, and all of this other stuff happened that was, you know, conventionally you would say, and indeed many of the kids in the troop were crying, you know, they wanted to go home, they missed their TV, you know. And I, for a while, I was like that too, but I began to think, you know, this is really cool out here. You know, I felt sort of liberated by the experience. And there's something wrong, I think, with the way we live. And it's not just that we have created this artificial environment. It's so artificial, we don't even understand how artificial it is, you know. There's something artificial about our, you know, like hugely artificial about our consciousness, I think. This sounds very philosophical, but, you know, we put incredible importance, we put this tremendous importance on the discriminating mind, you know, on the mind that is the thinking, analyzing mind. It's all we learn in school, right? There's nothing wrong with it, but it's all we learn in school, right? So, you know, when I went to school, you know, I started learning how to read books, and that was wonderful, you know. And I learned how to do math, which was a nightmare for me, for some reason. But I remember my father worked with me on the multiplication tables, and we had flashcards. And I wasn't doing well in math, so my father, he said, "We're going to get the flashcards," and he got the flashcards, and and he'd just start flipping them out, you know, 3 times 2, 2 times 7, you know, and you know, I got very fast. I could just, you know, 81, you know, and so I got through math, you know, like everybody else, I studied biology, I studied chemistry. In my biology class, one day we all got a frog, and we had to kill the frog and cut it open and look at its beating heart. And I did that, just like everybody else in my class. And then I went to college, and it's like I was developing all this time many good things. You know, really, learning how to read was a wonderful experience. You know, reading books was really a great experience. And I eventually got very interested in science. You know, I loved biology, and I never learned to love chemistry, but I did find biology really exciting. And so, you know, I got a lot out of my education. I'm not ungrateful, but like everybody else, all my education was like in discriminating intellect. And in our culture, we put so much emphasis on that. You know, that's what it's all about, you know. So, when I was in school, we had a few classes where we had a few classes that were devoted like to the arts, you know. So I remember in elementary school we had a period where the teacher would take out the finger paints, right? Maybe you did finger painting too, but we had these sheets of paper that were very shiny on one side, and the teacher would bring out these big jars of non-toxic paint, because, you know, little kids shove their fingers in their mouth. And she'd put like a big glob of red on somebody's piece of paper, and then you could just put your fingers in there and mush it around, and you could draw little designs and things like that. And it was thrilling, right? And there was something exciting about it that was different from learning how to read. You know, it was just, I found it very interesting, you know. And then we'd have little projects for a Thanksgiving. You'd have to trace your hand, open your hand, trace it out, and then you could make your hand into a turkey for Thanksgiving. That thumb was the head and this sort of thing. But I remember maybe around the third grade, all of that stopped, and then it was just like discriminating mind. Yes. So, you know, by the time we're adults, we have this very well-developed discriminating mind, but about many things we're quite ignorant. So, for example, you know, many people are quite emotionally immature. You know, I work with people who are really super smart, you know. They're really very, very brilliant people. And some of them are very immature emotionally. It's kind of shocking to see people who can be so brilliant and yet so immature. And it's because they haven't been well developed by their society. Nobody takes classes in like emotional maturity, right? So pretty much we grow up to be pretty ignorant people in terms of our emotional lives. You know, there's no class in high school where they say, let's explore our feelings today. You know, in fact, you know, people would roar with laughter at that. That seems so absurd. You know, that's very touchy-feely, right? People spend millions of dollars going to therapists, and the therapist says, let's explore those feelings, you know. And there's, by the way, there's nothing wrong with the therapist. In fact, maybe we should all be doing therapy all the way through high school, you know. We should have a class where we do some of this kind of analyzing our feelings and looking at things like, why are we afraid, you know. Those sorts of things are really essential to who we are, really central. And yet it's not part of our educational system at all. And of course, if you tried to make it part of the system, probably parents would get upset. They want their kids to be an MBA or a doctor, and Why are you wasting their time with this, right? You know, but you know, I was speaking to a man who is in charge of student life at Rutgers, and he said that the number of people who are suffering from stress-related disorders is going through the roof. You know, that kids, there's a lot of depression among, and these are students who are entering entering college, and they're just starting their lives. They're young adults, and apparently they have very high rates of depression and anxiety disorders. And even nationally, it's not like a tidal wave, but the number of college suicides has gone up. And, you know, I think this is because, you know, people just don't learn how to be intelligent about their emotions and their feelings. And so when they have transitions in their lives, they're totally ill-equipped. So, you know, I'm one of the worst people at Rutgers University. You know, I run the freshman English program. And many thousands of students have to take English 101, and it's a very tough course. And I'm sure many students wish I could burn in hell, you know. I'm always happy to think there's probably no hell, you know. But you know, it's a very difficult course for various reasons. I by the way, I swear this is the truth. I got an email from a student who took it the year before this one. And he said, remember me, I'm the guy who wrote you that angry email about English 101. And he said, but now I realize, now that I'm in this history course, I realize what you were trying, I swear I got this. And he said, keep up the good work. Now the other 5,000 students have not sent me an email yet. But I do get letters from people that say, thank you, you know, I'm in law school now, I really learned a lot. You know. So the point is, though, that, you know, I'm not popular at Rutgers. How did I get on this? Let's see. It's okay to talk. What was I saying? Oh, yes, somehow this is connected to that. I don't remember how. Oh, now I've got it. Education, right? Okay. When you do Taisho, you're not supposed to have a script. Just so you know, it's not that I'm a flake or I'm lazy. You're not supposed to have a script. You're just supposed to let the big mind tell you what to do. But sometimes the big mind is running very fast and I can't keep up. So students go through this very difficult course, and it causes them a lot of stress. All through high school, they've been getting A's and B's in their English courses. And then they take English 101 and they get an F. And they flip out and they run to student services and say, I'm having a nervous breakdown. And this is a problem in our culture because people, you know, a lot of, maybe in the old days, the pace of life was a little different. Maybe people had elders, you know, like a grandmother around the house who could be like a wise mentor. And people lived very different kinds of lives. You know, they didn't spend their life sitting in front of a television or a computer. They probably did a lot more interaction and so on. And so, you know, maybe they had less stress, and also maybe they had more resources for dealing with stress. But the truth is that, you know, in the modern world, it's pretty clear we don't get any preparation for having like emotional intelligence. And this is tied into an even bigger issue, which is that, you know, there's a different kind of intelligence altogether that's the foundation of our life. It's the foundation of our life, but we get no education at all. And in fact, we don't, most people don't even know it exists, right? You know, but the conscious mind is just a tiny little, like a little island in a great ocean. You know, it's a great ocean. And we aren't aware of it directly, but it's the essence of our existence, you know. Sometimes people fall in love and they don't know why it happens, right? They just fall in love. Usually they don't have a plan, you know, it's time to fall in love. They just fall in love. And sometimes they don't even want to fall in love, but something happens to them and they can be transformed by it, you know? I was kind of a city kid myself, you know, I was living on a military base, I watched a lot of TV. One day I went on a 50-mile hike out in the woods, and all of a sudden I felt so happy and so good. And if somebody said, why, I couldn't give you a reason. It's like, why did I feel so good out there in the Appalachian Mountains of Virginia? I don't know, but I felt fantastic. You know, when somebody falls in love, you don't know why, you know, but you feel fantastic. You know, if you like art, you know, you go to an art museum one day and you turn the corner and you look at this painting and you just say, wow, is that ever great, you know? I remember the first time I saw Georgia O'Keeffe's paintings. I just flipped out. I thought, who is this person, you know? And then I discovered she was already famous. I thought I had discovered her myself. You know? but the thing is, you know, we don't know why that happens. And also we don't know, you know, like we can be depressed and we don't know why we're depressed. Or we can be very, you know, a lot of people struggle with like low-grade depression, you know, where they're just unhappy every day a little bit. And they have no energy, you know. So they get up every day, and it's like they go to work, and there's like it's like you're running in sand, you know. A lot of people live like that, so like no energy. It's like low grade depression. And again, if you said, "Why are you depressed?" You know, you have a job, you have the, I don't know. It's all under the surface. It's all under the surface. It would, you know, there's something about the natural world which can be magical, and we don't know why. There's something about moments in our lives which can be magical. We don't know why, you know. And that we make up stories, you know, with our discriminating mind. We make up stories, but that's not really why the moment is so depressing or why this moment is so exciting. We go to school and we cultivate the discriminating mind in a very competitive atmosphere and judgmental atmosphere. But we don't develop emotional intelligence, and we don't develop this other intelligence. You know, so Zen is like a school for this other intelligence. You know, and that intelligence is it works on very different principles, very different rules. You know, so basically, you have to learn how to get access to this. We call it your big mind. You know. If you want to do math problems, you can sit down with a sharpened pencil and you can start doing the math problems. Or maybe you do them on your computer now, you know. If you want to write something, you can turn on your word processor and you can buckle down and start writing. And, you know, but the big mind's very different, you know. It requires a different set of tools, you know. And so a lot of Zen practice is learning how to tap this deeper intelligence. And it might seem weird, what we're doing might seem strange or weird or crazy even. You know, we're sitting motionless for hours on end, you know. You're focusing on your breath and you think, what is this all about? But you know, actually, Because we're so ignorant about the whole person, you know, we have all of these different states of consciousness we normally are oblivious to. And as you're sitting on the cushion, you're going through, you could say, the layers of your mind, and you're encountering all of these different states of consciousness. And eventually you get into these states of consciousness that are very closely connected to that part of the mind you can't know intellectually, right? And the first, you know, what begins to happen in Zen is that there's like a breakdown of the wall between the unconscious mind and the conscious mind. And this happens to people naturally, like when you go out into the woods, or sometimes when people fall in love, you know, or, you know, when you listen to a piece of music, it all of a sudden it's like there's a wall between your unconscious mind and your little discriminating mind, and it goes down. And it's like the world becomes more whole and complete on those special occasions. And Zen is a way of deepening that experience and taking it out of the realm of like the very special, rare experiences, like going to a musical performance or a museum, and experiencing it in ordinary everyday life, you know. And so, when you sit on the cushion, if you watch your breath, eventually your mind is going to become blank and still, and little by little, you will be getting closer and closer to this what we call your big mind, your unconscious mind, and then at some point, it's like a little door opens up. And the unconscious sort of enters your body, you know, and you have an insight, or you feel you have a transformative moment. And this is like whole being. This is like 100% life. And it, at that point, you can't really say it's your life anymore. It's like the life of the universe. And it's like connecting to everything around you in an unselfconscious way. And that feeling is we're like fish. So often in our lives, we're like fish stranded on the shore, gasping for air, right? Or gasping for oxygen. And when you do Zazen, even though it's difficult and it might be frightening, and you might be fighting the whole time going, don't put me in that lake, whatever you do, you know. That looks like a terrible place, you know. When you finally go into the lake, you realize, my God, this is great, you know. And this is about like swimming in the ocean of Mu. Mu is this, is our word for the mind. When the mind is blank and still, you're at the door into the unconscious. And our word for that is Mu. And if you stay there long enough, the door opens and you begin to make contact with the world in a bigger way, in a more unified way. But it's a very complex process. You know, the first stage of Zen is learning how to have a samadhi mind, which is like a unified mind. So you're sitting on the cushion, and you're thinking all this stuff, and these thoughts are flowing, and you keep trying to focus on your breath. And then one time, one day, you're going to be able to watch the breath, and it's breath, 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 breath. And it's like the thoughts aren't completely gone, but they're over at the side, and your mind is able to focus like a flashlight on your breath. Maybe just for a few seconds, and maybe eventually for long periods of time. But that's like stage one, that's samadhi. And then if you keep watching your breath, at some point you'll notice that your mind is blank and dark, or blank and still. And this is what we call Mu. And spending a lot of time in that blank mind is very, very important for the reason I said. It's like the door into your bigger intelligence, you know. And we spend a lot of time with Mu, you know. And then you have to learn how to use your unconscious mind. And you can't command it. It's not like turning on the computer and starting to write, you know. You have to be like receptive and empty. And the koans are like subliminal prompts. They're like subliminal prompts, you know. A friend of mine is in the real estate business. My neighbor John is in the real estate business, and he says one of the gimmicks people use to sell houses is that they bake a pie. You bake an apple pie in the house before the clients come, right? So you're selling your house, you clean it up, you decorate it, and then you put the pie in the oven and you bake it, and then an hour later the people show up and they think, oh my God, what a wonderful house. I have the most cozy feeling here, right? And they might not even notice there's like an apple pie smell, right? This is like subliminal cue, right? Well, koans are like this. They're like subliminal cues. So if somebody says, what's the sound of one hand clapping? You know, you're not supposed to figure it out. It's a subliminal cue. And you internalize it by repeating one hand clapping, one hand clapping, one hand clapping. And you sit in that blankness, and it's like the koan is like a coin that you put into the machine, right? And you put your coin in, and you don't know what's going to come out at the bottom of the machine. You know, it's like a Coke machine, right? It sounds a little sacrilegious, but you know, basically you put your quarter into the machine, and then you don't know what's going to come out. It could be a Coke, it could be a Pepsi, it could be Mountain Dew, you know, it could be Dasani sparkling water, you know, and you don't know because it's an unconscious process, you know. So the koan is like one hand clapping. You put that into the machine, and then when you come into Dokusan, you just have to tell the teacher what came out of the little opening, the little door, and you can say, it was Mountain Dew, you know, and I go, no, not quite, you know. Okay? And so you go back and you put the coin back in, you know, and then it's Pepsi. No, not yet. Keep going, you know, or Dasani, closer. You know? So it's like that, you know. You don't control it, but you get to be very deeply, the more that door opens between the little mind and the big mind, the more unified your intelligence becomes, you know. And eventually you become, you know, what we normally say, an intuitive person. We in our culture, again, because we are so poorly educated, you know, because only one hemisphere gets all the attention, you know, we don't understand what it means to be deeply intuitive, you know. Somebody like Mozart could sit down and compose a sonata, you know, in like a day that nobody can equal. And people thought, how the hell does he do this, you know? And indeed, you know, somehow he was just born with a door open between, you know, when it came to music, between those two parts of his mind. And it was just like, came pouring out. You know, we're not Mozarts, but we can learn how to have that unified mind. And so the more we go through this process, the more unified we become and the more open we become. You know, we're really very frightened of the big mind, even though it's our true nature. And we, you know, we're so afraid of getting the wrong answer, or we have so many anxieties about ourselves. And all our lives we've been getting penalized for giving the wrong answer. You know, so when you took that math test, you know, you got a 46, Mr. Spellmeyer. You know, we might have to keep you back. It's like, oh my God. You know, oh my God. So we're terrified of that, right? But you have to get a lot of answers wrong in order to improve this ability. You know, you're going to come in with the wrong answer a lot, and it's okay. You have to be open to whatever comes up. So, you know, you're sitting in Mu, and you're saying, one hand clapping, and you just have to be open. And you come in and say, is it this? And I'll say, not quite. You know, little by little, you get faster and faster. I mean, there are people here today who have been answering koan, one koan a day. You know, that's in this room. Now, I have to tell you the truth. Please don't get discouraged, because I spent 5 years on my first koan, okay? So when you think of somebody answering a koan a day, it's heartbreaking. You think, oh my God, you know. But it's just practice. You know, it's just practice. It's like anything else. You know, so, you know, basically, you go through this process, and, you know, eventually, you know, people who have been doing this can knock off a koan every sesshin or so. And eventually, even like one a day, you know, not all the time, but you know, it's like bing, bing, bing. And it's just they've learned how to be, not to cling too much to the small self, and be more in the big mind. And the more we're available to the big mind, the more flexible our awareness becomes. Yeah? And the more that, you know, as I say, you know, that sense of connectedness happens to us accidentally sometime. You know, when we hitchhike across America, or when we are in a forest, but you know, then it goes away and we don't know how it happened. But there's an art to this that you can cultivate, and you know, you can have that experience of connectedness much more often than once a year or once every 10 years. You know, you can have it a lot, you know. And it's really a different world when that's the case. So, as usual, that all seemed to have nothing to do with the koan. A monk asked national teacher Zhang of Nanyang, what is the varochana of one's own body? A way to put that is, you know, how can you be Buddha in your own body? You know, to be Buddha in your own body, to be fully awake in your own body, you know, your own self fully awake, you know. And that's when the barrier goes down between the little mind and the big mind. And there's unified mind in accord with the way, right? Normally, we're like a fish on the shore trying to breathe, right? And then when that door opens up, you're suddenly like a fish in the ocean. And people don't know the ocean, you know, because we're so ignorant and we've been so badly educated, we don't realize we belong in the ocean is our true home, you know. So the more time we spend in the big mind, the happier you are. And it's, you know, life, you don't owe it to the universe to be miserable, right? That's a big mistake. You know, basically, the universe is our home. You know, one of the reasons we can feel so good in nature is because this is where we belong, you know. We create an artificial world that causes endless suffering. But it has to do with the way we've constructed our consciousness. So a monk asked national teacher Zhang of Nanyang, what is the varochana of one's own body? Can I be a Buddha in my own body? The national teacher said, bring me the pitcher of clean water. A monk brought the pitcher. The national teacher said, put it back. The monk asked again, what is varochana in one's own body? The national teacher said, the ancient Buddha is long gone. So, birds coursing in the sky, fish being in the water, in rivers and lakes forgetting, in clouds and sky they get their will. The doubting mind, a single thread, before the face 1,000 miles, knowing benevolence, requiting benevolence, how many people do? Life can be really wonderful, or it can be really terrifying. and unhappy, necessarily so. So I feel very sorry for all those kids who, you know, are entering their adult lives terrified. And the world can be a scary place if you don't know how to cope. So please, everybody's come here to practice this art of the unified mind. And it's a wonderful experience. It's so liberating. It's so beautiful. And the world is such a different place. I'll stop in just one second. A person came into Dokusan last night and said, after sitting all day and feeling kind of lousy about practice, this person went out into the woods, and it was like an enchanted forest, you know, basically. And this is, life can be really amazing. These ordinary things can be really amazing when we're not separate. So anyway, today we have this wonderful opportunity to sit at the door of the big mind and wait for it to open. And it may or may not open today, but if you keep sitting, wonderful things will happen.